on my co-moderator, Matt Lambert, to kick off today's session. Matt?
Yeah, thank you, Jean, and thanks for everyone who signed in today. Today's topic is using fish data to monitor remedy effectiveness. Specifically, we're going to focus in on using this as it relates to contaminated sediment sites and the Superfund program. It is probably relevant to a wide variety of programs that are out there, and we'll touch on some aspects, but you know, keep it in mind that it's a Superfund program focused talk today. And it is meant to supplement a fact sheet that we put out several years ago called the Sediment Assessment and Monitoring Sheets. And if you are interested in this topic, you can find more information in SAMS number one under the same title as that. You'll find links to that, again, where Jean pointed out, and also at the end of today's talk. So I am moderating today, and I come to you from the Superfund Program Science Policy Branch. My portfolio includes technical and policy support for contaminated sediment sites. I am a chemist by training, and so I will be moderating today. Our first speaker is Dean Govea. Dean is a technical director at ICF International with 30 years of experience as an environmental chemist and as a project manager. He's applied fish and biota sampling programs over those 30 years, currently serving as the team manager for EPA Region 3 Environmental Services Assistant Team contract. We'll also hear two case studies where RPMs have applied fish monitoring to investigate remedial effectiveness at their site. The first case study you'll hear is from Jim Honenberg about the Fox River Superfund site. Jim was the RPM there for many years and recently retired this last January. So we're lucky to have him. He's come back from retirement just giving a free talk today to share his experiences as RPM there. Our second talk will be from Gary Klawinski about the Hudson River PCB Superfund site, another of our biggest sites, and they've done quite a bit of fish monitoring there. And Gary Klawinski has 30 years of experience, both as an environmental and engineering project manager with extensive Superfund experience. So with that, you should see shortly on your screen two polling questions show up. And the first one, how many years of site characterization or remediation experience do you have? And the second one, have you led or participated in biota sampling programs before? So I'll give you just a moment to click on an answer for us.
Just a quick reminder, to vote in those interactive polls, you'll simply need to click on the circle to the left of the answer that most closely matches your reply. If you happen to be participating in a group, you'll need to fight it out amongst yourself to cast a representative vote for the entire group joining you there.
All right. Thanks, Jean. And it looks like some folks are still voting, but we have almost 76% of you have participated in a fish tissue sampling program in the past, and about the remainder have not. And it also looks like we have quite an experienced crowd, 65% of you with 10 years or more experience, and kind of evenly spread amongst the other categories here. So hopefully today's talk will be informative for everybody, and that thank you for your answers. That'll help us tailor our talk today. Here's the outline for our talk. And we will provide an overview of fish sampling, both generally and as it applies to Superfund remediation. Six-step process. This is EPA data quality objective process. We are going to go off the 2005 sediment guidance, as that is particularly focused on both fish and sediment issues. Within that six-step process, they'll focus a lot on the planning factors for setting up your sampling program, and both analytical questions for the fish, but also analyzing the data. And again, we've mentioned the two case studies. So our objective for today's talk is to look at sites that have this RAO, the remedial action objective, where you're attempting to reduce human health or eco risk due to consuming fish. So the programs we're talking about are collecting fish and analyzing them for contaminants in order to go into that assessment. I'll mention just two documents. We've mentioned them before. Here is an image of the SAMS using fish tissue data to monitor remedy effectiveness. This was the first one that we did. These are more than a fact sheet. They're somewhere between 15 and 30 pages long. We have a whole series of them now. And so here's the reference for that. And this is the basis of today's talk. The other important guidance, and you know, we're taking a lot of today's talk from this as well, as the 2005 Contaminated Sediment Remediation Guidance for Hazardous Waste Sites. And Chapter 8 is the relevant chapter for long-term monitoring. Now with that, I will turn things over to Dean. Dean Gavea.
Thanks, Matt. As Matt mentioned, I'm a chemist and a data quality, data analysis specialist, work designing these sampling programs and supporting the evaluation of others. So there's another poll question I've got here. Many of us have done fish tissue or other biota sampling and analysis programs. My question is, what was it supporting? They've been around for a long time, primarily eco and human health, risk assessments, fish advisories, in some cases things like sentinel programs with cage mussels looking at aerial limits or transport issues. However, the focus here is obviously using it for remedy effectiveness, which my sense, and I think a lot of the sense of what we've been talking to, is it's not used that much in those situations, or it isn't used as much as it should be, or it hasn't been in the past, and that's why one of the reasons we're focusing on it. And I think, as you can see, only a third of the people they really used it for remedy monitoring, whereas you know, three-quarters of us have used it in risk assessments of one way or another. So I think that is an interesting thing, because we're often going to talk about that. In all programs, the key to success is in the planning, and we're going to spend some time today on understanding how it's similar, how it's unique when applying that planning to remedy effectiveness. I'm just going to move on to the next slide here. I don't see my arrows.
Dean, if you need any help, try wiggling that green pointer.
Okay.
On the screen, and then you might find that your keyboard starts working.
Jean, if you could just move to the next slide, I'll start talking.
Absolutely.
And we'll see if I can get control. Okay, the key to any monitoring program is to ensure that the data we collect are representative of the situation we're trying to measure. In this case, we're trying to measure remedy effectiveness, which means the RAOs have been achieved, the cleanup, chemical and biological cleanup levels are met and maintained over time, and the risk is reduced to acceptable levels. The key in evaluation of a remedy is that we really just have four possible answers we're looking to get to. And if we put this in terms of our schooling and education, we all know multiple choice is a lot easier than essays. So all we're trying to establish are one of these four options. Either the remedy is complete. Second, although the remedy isn't complete, it's showing progress towards a goal. The third option, the remedy is showing no signs of progress and perhaps should be reconsidered. And the fourth one, the data is insufficient at this time. And while that sounds horrible, oftentimes early on in the process, it's going to take a little bit of data accumulation to understand how we're measuring, whether we're seeing that reduction in trend that we want to see. Keep this in mind as we talk about the design of the program. The scope of our answers that we're looking for is highly limited. The webinar is organized, as Matt said, around the key reference documents that he discussed. And first, I'm going to talk about the six-step planning process in general. That basically comes from the sediment remediation guidance. And then we're going to talk about some detail on the specific factors, and that primarily comes from the second document, the SAMS document that we're going to talk about. They're briefly going to talk about analyzing the results, and then I'm going to turn it over to our experts who are going to talk about their case studies, their lessons learned, and their success stories. So, as I said, the six-step process comes from this document. It provides a good but a broad overview of the process to getting good data that supports decision-making, and in particular, we're going to focus on Chapter 8. The six-step process that it defines, the graphic on the right is right out of the guidance document, and on the left, I've boiled it down to the steps. This is very familiar to us, or similar to the DQO, or the data quality objective process, but it is a little bit different, and it, although they parallel each other, and the purpose is similar, they are a little bit different. It really describes how to go from a problem or a question to a decision. Note that I didn't say it gets us to an answer or a resolution, because as most of you are experienced enough to know, we rarely get to an answer or a resolution very quickly or very sort of effectively. It's usually broken down into smaller issues, and that's how we're able to make a decision with confidence and then recast the problem and move on to the next step. But the six steps of identify objectives, develop hypothesis, formulate the decision rule, design the plan, conduct the analysis, and make the decision. Like I say, it's similar to the DQO process, slightly different. We are primarily going to spend the bulk of this webinar talking about step four, designing the plan. But I want to quickly get us through these early steps to talk about the more detailed one. And remember, as I said, throughout this, we're going to be talking about getting one of those four answers, from the remedy's complete to we don't have enough data, but we're going to do it through this process. So the most important element in developing an effective monitoring plan is to identify clear and specific monitoring objectives. Inadequate or vague monitoring objectives leads to uncertainty, but why the monitoring is being conducted, how the data will be used, how it's going to be interpreted. Specific ones help us focus that experimental design and achieve the useful information. Typically with remedy effectiveness, this is pretty straightforward because the ROD lays out very clear objectives. But again, I'm going to point back to the fact that in evaluating remedy effectiveness, you may choose not to evaluate every aspect of the ROD. Especially early on, you may be just looking for the first signs or indicators of progress, not necessarily a demonstration of completion. And in that case, you may not be looking at identifying objectives that take you all the way through the end of the ROD. However, when identifying monitoring objectives, other than those already established in decision and enforcement documents, you need to realize that at that point, you do need to bring in all the concerned stakeholders, from the public to the states to pretty much everybody involved, because of the transparency that EPA is always seeking. You don't want to have any questions along with why are we not doing some aspect of the ROD or why are we doing something different than it's in the ROD. And the answer that it's an early indicator and you're looking for progress may well work with some of the technical people, but you may have a little more difficulty explaining it throughout the process. So, this example comes right out of the sediment remediation guidance, and it's a very clear one to me. The ROD establishes fish levels as well as sediment levels. In this case, fish consumption advisory for this site of 0.05 ppm and a cleanup level of 0.5 ppm in total PCBs and sediment. So again, 9 times out of 10, or even more frequently, the ROD is going to be very clear and you're going to be following the ROD, so that's why we're going through this part quickly. The only times you'll be changing it is when you're usually reducing from the ROD, or you're looking at the baseline data and having to make some changes there, but we'll talk about that. The monitoring hypotheses are just statements or questions that show the relationship between the activity, such as the sediment remediation, and the expected outcomes. This is analogous to step one, the problem formulation of the DQO process that many people are familiar with. It can be a question or a statement. It can be a statement, the site activity has been successful in reaching its goals, or it could be a question, has it? The guidance, the EPA's monitoring guidance suggests the concept of a conceptual model may be helpful in identifying and organizing the hypotheses, but in general, again, this is a pretty straightforward step from the ROD. The PCB concentration in the sediment has reached the cleanup level of 0.5, and the fish tissue goal has reached 0.05. So, again, I don't think we're talking rocket science and jumping from one to the other. Now we're going to step three, formulate the decision rules. Again, this is an early step in the phase. It's usually an if-then statement that defines the condition that would cause the decision maker to take an action, and it usually has those four elements that are on the screen, the parameter, the level, the expected outcome, and the alternative action. And so a typical step three example, again, coming directly out of the remediation guidance, in this case, you'll notice an important aspect that I was talking about before. Here, they've raised the level to 0.8 ppm because, again, they're not necessarily interested in demonstrating completeness. They're interested in demonstrating movement towards or progress towards it, and they put a timeline on it. So this is a good example of the ROD is very clear on one thing, but as you look at what your purpose is to demonstrate progress as opposed to completeness, you may well change this. But you'll also notice here that they've capped it and said within 5 years, we'll revisit the frequency. That's a pretty common way of attacking this. Other ways you may see or you may consider as we talk about designing the programs is having an annual program versus a biannual program with more things being added in later on to show the completeness or addressing the ROD. But again, this step three example is very simple, even though it makes a change from the earlier ones. The step four, the designing the plan, this is where it sort of starts to get more complicated. This is where the rubber meets the road, and your efforts are going to have to kick up. There's a lot of information that's going to come into this designing the plan that you haven't really discussed up till now, which is why we're doing this webinar, why we're going to focus on step four. So let's take a look at an example of the plan that's coming out of those first three steps, and I think you'll be a little bit surprised at the amount of detail that they're considering here. So we went from that step three to, I'll give you a moment to read it, quite a bit of detail, including species, numbers, locations, when, where, how you're going to take the samples, what type of samples. There's clearly a lot of steps between that three and four, and I think that's where the SAMS really helps out, saying, well, what are the options? What are the data we need to look at? How do I go from that step three to that step four? It's not that this type of information isn't necessarily reflected in the ROD, although there may be pieces of it in there. This is where you're going to have to really make some decision to dig into the factors, the information, to jump from these sort of vague hypotheses, sort of vague plans to now I have a plan that tells me, if not exactly what I want to do, pretty tightly defined what I want to do. So the next step we're going to talk about is what factors come into that. But before I do, I guess before I move off of the six-step process, I would ask, if we've got questions, Matt, if there's anything we should be addressing at this point through the six steps without going into those factors that affect the details we've got on four.
Yeah, thanks, Dean. I don't see any questions currently in there. Folks, if you do have a question now, feel free to type it into the Q&A box, and I'll upload it to Dean.
Okay. Well, then we'll just keep going.
And Dean, I'll let you know if we get any. Thanks.
Okay. As far as the organization of this, we'll probably stop again at the end of the planning factors to take any questions that deal with sort of anything up till that point, but we'll certainly hit anything in the six-step process there as well. Okay. As I noted, the sediment remediation guidance tends to be broad. It's good. It's applicable. It's got some great information in there. But I feel that, Us Ready program has developed a lot of good references and guidance materials that can really help programs learn from the best practices. And I think that the sediment assessment and monitoring sheet number one is one such document. And I, would highly recommend that as a takeaway from this webinar. If you get nothing else, go there for some information, much of which we're going to talk about here, but it's presented in a little different way at the same time. Sometimes when I start on these program designs, my brain sort of feels just like this word cloud. The factors and things to consider popping up, stepping on each other, intersecting, sometimes distracting from it. But we do what we can, break it down piece by piece, get a handle on this sort of immediate feeling of chaos that hits me when I see these word clouds. And, where do we start and where do we end and how do we step through this? As always, we start at the beginning with the most basic and the things that affect sort of the later factors more. And the first of that is contaminants of concern. Clearly, the contaminants of concern affect the overall program from deciding the organism species, the sample types, the analytical methods, all aspects of the sample program design. The CUCs are also identified in the RIFSs and the RODs. But remember, where we're looking for signs of progress, not demonstrations of completion, there isn't necessarily a one-to-one there. You may select certain COCs that reflect the change easier. The other aspect of this is thinking about the baseline data that you've got, because in measuring remedy effectiveness, the first key number you've got is a good understanding of the baseline data, which, is not sort of old data that was, taken when the site was out of control and, there was not an understanding of sort of the inputs and the outputs. Really, the baseline data should consist of multiple years of sampling data collected as part of a long-term monitoring plan, but prior to construction. The baseline data, the older data may be useful in planning and identifying how it's going to happen, but it's really not good enough for detecting a trend once the site has been sort of stabilized and entered that process of construction, prior to construction. The baseline data set needs to adequately characterize the population variability to facilitate trend analysis once the long-term monitoring begins. So it's not as if you're just going to get a number out of that says my PCBs are X. You need to understand what the variability around that number is for the different size ranges, species. This is why multiple years are recommended. Rarely is 1 year, no matter how significant, going to be adequate to establish a baseline set of data. EPA generally encourages 3 years of baseline data using exactly the same plan as for the LTM. That means consistent sampling methods, consistent analytical methods. This is an important aspect of it. So we're identifying the COCs. Again, you may identify that as something where you're going to have it tiered by years. It's fairly common to have 1 year of a sampling be a limited list and then the second year be a full list or something along those lines, especially where there's many contaminants of concerns and multiple analyses that are required to do it, because you're always looking for cost effectiveness. So if you are considering downsizing the list from the rod, you need to make sure that you consider that different compounds react and remediate differently. They bioaccumulate. Fate and transport is different. Don't ignore COCs favoring a short list if you don't have the justification that you can expect a change in one to be paralleled by similar changes in the others. If you're downsizing the COC list for cost effectiveness in order to detect this trend towards cleanup, make sure you have a decision rule that increases the list to a full list as you start to demonstrate the cleanup. or, as I said, make sure you have a tier program that makes allows you to benchmark where you are as you move through the process. Considering the differences when you're reducing that contaminant COC list, the contaminant types, the metals versus organics, different types of organics, different bioaccumulation rates, as well as effect on various life stages, species, target owners, everything is going to affect whether you're measuring something that is really indicative or whether you're hopefully not going to miss something that would be an early sign. Sometimes, given the complexity of this, it is more cost-effective to analyze for all COCs rather than try and come to some ultimate agreement with multiple parties, multiple stakeholders that some reduced list is going to work for you. Because you're going to have to explain this not only to EPA, but to the public so that everyone's on board with this, you know, cost-effective approach of limiting the list. The next step and the next factor that we often talk about is identifying the species. And again, that's identified in the rods generally, but again, we're looking for the signs of a trend, not necessarily the completion, so you may not be able to get every fish every time because of availability and prevalence, because of size limits. You may need to do some reduced sampling at first, look for the trend, and then come back and demonstrate completion at some point. Clearly, fish species metabolize, degrade the contaminants differently. They don't all pose the same level of risk for human or ecological, human consumption or ecological risk, and the species affect many other aspects of the program, including sample locations, types, frequencies, and analysis. You may need to consider different factors affecting, you know, angler catches and what they're actually catching, whether that's cultural, ethnic factors, language accessibility, whether people are obeying fish advisories or whether there is a fish advisory in place at that point. Typically there would be. But we've had sites where it simply wasn't being enforced or wasn't being obeyed, and, you know, it affects, affects a lot of how you're going to approach this. Again, when you're reducing the list from the species that you maybe want, ideally it may be because of the ability to collect fish, population changes, numbers, size ranges. The other aspect of identifying species is to develop a comparable national data, set of data for Superfund remedies. Site managers have been encouraged to use a bottom feeder, such as a channel catfish, brown, black, or yellow bullhead, as well as a game fish, such as smallmouth bass, largemouth bass, or walleye. But again, you're going to be led in a certain direction based on your site, your conditions, your rod. But as you start to, if you start to make changes because of availability, you need to, or because of, you're trying to find those early indicators, you need to think about some of the factors that are going to allow you to have an early indication. Higher lipid contents should mean higher, greater accumulation, should be more receptive to changes with time, especially in the smaller size classes. So, you know, one of the things to consider is shellfish. They're immobile, relatively immobile. They can give a good representation of the conditions of the site, as you know, you can with small non-game fish, sort of a high site fidelity. But you also want to consider, again, that there's enough individuals or that the range and species are available enough volume that you can collect these samples over time. The sample type, is this graphic really is twofold. There's the organism type and the sample type of the sample that's being analyzed. For the organism type, difference in gender and life stages are important. For example, selenium is known to affect the young life stages of fish. If you've got a selenium as a contaminant of concern, it's going to determine what type of sample you need to get. because it does not affect the larger adult stages. It affects the earlier stages. Variations in size. You know, they often say the smallest fish should be 75% of the largest fish. And always game fish should be of legal size when they do this. So the sample type, the organism type that you're taking is going to have a lot of a large effect on what you're doing. You know, one of the things that's often not taken into account is the limitations in identifying the species and varieties. Can you really tell them apart readily? We've been at sites where we've gotten such narrow definitions of the fish as far as what counts as, a brown bullhead versus a black bullhead. You know, we've had to go to DNA testing. I know on one site for EPA for a fish market, it wasn't a sampling, they were testing for a fish market, they did DNA testing of all the fish that were taken and found 70% of them mislabeled. Now I know that part of that was sort of financial concerns, but there are others that were just honest mislabelings of the fish by people who should know better, but it's tough when your rod is very specific. For determining best sample analyses, not just the organism type, you're going to be talking about whole body versus fillet, offal, skin on, skin off. A lot of this is going to be determined you're going to want to set this for the baseline data, and you want to be comparable during your long-term monitoring. The other piece to consider is the impact on reporting limits. If you're picking small species and small samples, you're definitely going to be pushing yourselves into the composite situation, which isn't necessarily an issue, but it does sort of predefine where you're going. The number of samples, that's going to be critical, obviously. You're trying to be cost-effective. You're trying to collect samples. Many states for fish advisories, they basically prefer individual sampling. The Superfund program has a preference for composite sampling. If the mass of the individual sample is low, you're definitely going to be looking at taking composite sampling. And again, you're going to want to make sure it's reflected in the baseline data as well as your longer-term monitoring. So these decisions are relatively early on, and you don't want to make a change as you're moving forward in years, because the data just becomes incomparable. You need to look at the analytical costs for this sampling as well as the error bar. The advantage of individual samples is you don't miss any results. You can understand exactly what each fish is. The advantage of the composite is that you average out some of these anomalous or unexplained highs with the fish, you have a better understanding of the population as a whole, which is why really Superfund looks to the composite sampling. An important aspect of the composite sampling is going to be determining what your composite strategy is going to be. Generally, as a rule of thumb, and only a rule of thumb, a minimum of 5 composites with 5 fish per composite is listed as sufficient to determine a 50% decrease with a 90% level of confidence. Again, that is at best a rule of thumb, but it gives you an idea of what you're working with. Really what EPA would like to see on the Superfund program is power analysis to determine the minimum number of fish to be collected and analyzed in order to detect a specified minimum significant difference in the chemical residue over time. Establishing an appropriate level of power when designing the monitoring program is as important as establishing the significance level, and it's often a cost-benefit analysis of what are we going to spend and what are we going to be able to determine. But the choice of power in combination with other factors really can make the data usable or uninterpretable, and so it's important to walk through the process. We're not going to walk through a lot of this power analysis today. I would point out that the Sam's document that I've referenced often has a great example of sort of walking of how to calculate the powers. I've also found, and I can post this link at some point once I'm done speaking, I found a good technical memorandum from the WADA program that deals really with best management practice implementation for watersheds, but it goes through the same process, and I think it has a really nice detail of general to specific and how to calculate sort of the power analysis to understand when you're detecting the minimal change. The graph curves that I've got on this slide really step through the 25, 35, and 50% minimal detectable decrease, and it really helps you understand how the number of samples affects it. Okay. Switching gears a little bit, talking back on the factors, we're going to talk about locations. The program design needs to take into account locations when deciding the frequency, the seasonality, as well as other factors. The site size, the complexity, known fishing locations, whether you're focused on human consumption or ecological issues might determine that. Accessibility are all going to come into play when you're talking about locations, and in particular the techniques you're going to use. Electrofishing is good, and maybe I wouldn't say it's a preferred technique, but it's a very common technique. It has been shown to be selectively effective, both in accessibility and getting to the point where the fish are that you're looking for. It just cannot ensure equal effectiveness. All the fish may be stunned, but it may be as simple as some fish go deeper or leave the area as soon as the initial disturbance with the boats and the people. So this is sort of the go-to method of one of these types of electrofishing, but don't start with the assumption that the locations have to be accessible by stun boat. There are other options, both as far as things like backpack stunning, as well as there have been plenty of demonstration of programs where angling had to be or was used effectively to get a population of fish that was reliable, game size, et cetera. The timing has two aspects of it, both the frequency, how often are we doing it? That may be, as I said before, you may have multiple events with multiple tiered sort of levels of depth. You typically want to get at least two sampling events before the five-year review for the comparison, but it also has to do with timing of when seasonality-wise, and that is going to depend on life stages, habits, abundance, size, fish, the lipid content. There's lots of factors that are going to talk about when seasonally you're going to want to do these events, and it's going to be very specific to your species that you're taking, your site geography or bathymetry or how the site logistics are, but you definitely need to consider these factors. Some of the timing effects that have been discussed, during the spring when the lipid content is typically low, that may not be the appropriate time to sample. Within 1 month of a spawning season, within several months of fish stocking that is contiguous with your body of water, unless it's cordoned off, there's going to be issues there. So, at methylmercury sites, collecting fish in the late summer or early autumn is recommended because methylation is occurring, for example. That's one where the specific target compound you're looking for may affect your seasonality. Looking at the analysis, obviously knowing the type of analysis is going to be conducted is necessary for a successful program. But it's also going to affect the quantity and types of samples. You're going to need to look at the minimum sample volumes that are needed for that analysis. You may also be able to work with modified techniques, micro-extraction, that allows you to get lower with less sample, or you may need to consider, again, going backwards, taking a look at your compositing program and saying, is this going to give us enough sample if I'm taking, really small sample sizes or organisms? So just going back and thinking about the step four design plan that we laid out in the first half of the webinar, we're going to go back and take a look at it. And remember, step three was a very basic one. Step four had all these details, Let's take a moment to read through this. And as you read through it, think about the factors that we just talked about. And I think you'll see why we say that going through these factors is important, because in order to get to this level of detail, you'll see that many of these come out. You've got the target species, the COCs. Well, we kind of had a handle on some of that from the rod, but now we've nailed it down. The numbers of samples, the locations. We're talking about gender, timing, pretty much all the factors we just talked about, whether it's going to be skin-on fillets, whether we're going to do the PCBs by, Arachlor's congeners, all 209 PCB congeners or some small, shorter list for cost effectiveness. All this needs to be defined as part of your plan. And again, ideally, all this is exactly comparable in your baseline data as it is in your longer-term data. You're going to get 3 years of baseline data to give a nice baseline so that we can look at not just the number but the statistical variation. And then as you take the sampling, you can make that determination of whether there is a trend or not. So we've walked all the way through, hopefully not too quickly, of the design of a detailed plan. Before we talk about sort of analysis and then I pass it on to the case studies, I guess I just want to take a moment to find out if there are any questions at this point.
Hey, Dean. Yep, we have lots of questions coming in, and a variety of them are about age and size. So I'm going to do my best to boil many of them into just a few. And one question is related to age and size, just pointing out that age often correlates better to contaminant concentration than size. How do you get at fish age? Is fish size good enough for that correlation with contamination? That there. I'll get to some of the others.
Okay, well, I think that's where the 3 years of baseline data really comes in, because it depends on so many site factors, on introduction of new fish, of the same species, whether you're in a contiguous water body or it's being fished. So whether you're talking game fish or non-game fish. So there's a lot of factors there. But if you've got the good baseline data set, again, you're looking not just at what my number is, but what's my variability and how does it correlate. I certainly would agree that age is often a better indicator, but short of where you've got really sort of reliable indicators on that, it's very difficult to make that determination.
Okay, and two similar questions, I guess. One would be, you're trying to get the 75%, the smallest to be the within 75% of the biggest. Do you achieve that by tossing out the big ones, the small ones, a little of both? Are you worried about biasing your data set one direction or the other?
That's a great question. Usually we try and handle this in the sampling plan directly as part of getting it approved all the way through, that how we're going to handle it. We would normally tend to exclude on the larger size, and then if we've got enough, do individual analyses of those to see how they fit within the range of the others, because usually, again, the larger size, you've got enough fish there to do the individual analyses. But again, I would point to, what you're doing on the baseline data, you want to be doing moving forward. But like I said, if we had to exclude something, we usually exclude the larger. But it's part of, you know, is it sort of a super anomalous issue, you know, where, you know, there is sort of one, you know, monster fish that someone caught that's, you know, sort of on the upper end, or is it the fact that you've, in order to get your sample count, you've got much smaller ones? But again, part of that is getting it approved in the planning process and making sure everybody's on the same page. And if you did the same thing in the baseline data as you did in the out years, I think that variability and bias is offset or at least taken into account in the trend analysis.
Excellent. Thanks. I see lots of other questions on this age topic, but I want to move to some of the other questions coming in. And one question I think is particularly pertinent at Superfund sites is fish tissue monitoring better indication of contamination than, say, sediment or water column? This question is particularly for PCBs. And I think I would add in another question that came in, and you know, how does fish monitoring relate to the use of passive samplers?
In relation to your first question, I was going to raise passive samples as the other option. I think there's complexities in taking water column and sediment data and understanding what's bioavailable. When you're talking remedy effectiveness, there's not usually a lot of flexibility in how you're going to have a sediment level, you're going to have a fish tissue level, and you're going to need to deal with that. But in determining which is sort of better overall on the site, oftentimes it's a combination of all of them. You're going to have you're going to need that baseline data on the sediments in the water column, but if you don't have it in the fish, you really don't understand the bioavailability. And then I was going to say, the passive samplers can help emulate, if you will, bioavailability and can provide you some data as to that, but the acceptability of that is a little bit varying across states and the public. I think it asks people to make a mental leap that it's another hill you have to climb, as it were.
And I can follow that up, Dean, from just a Superfund program perspective would be our monitoring to see if we've achieved our RAOs should be tied to the risk level. And for an RAO of human health risk from eating fish, that's most tightly tied to game fish. However, game fish often have a wide range, so you might not know how much they're staying at your site. So there's always good reason to go and collect several lines of evidence, whether that's passive sampling and water column and sediment. That's for the site to figure out ahead of time.
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's a good point. Great point.
Okay, we have a variety of other questions, but I want to get back to our schedule. I will try to either respond or push these to our next Q&A session. So,
okay.
Dean,
and if we have time at the end, we can come back to some of those as well, Matt. Get some input from others as well. But let me move on to analyzing the results. Okay. Again, as I said, the bulk of what we're going to be dealing with is in the designing of the plan, and we've talked about that. But I do want to cover those last couple steps for completeness so that people understand how this six-step process works. Again, given the level of experience, it's very similar to the DQO process, but I think there are a couple important distinctions in my mind. After the performance of the program, the collection of the data, that is the appropriate time to assess the data quality. Hopefully you went through the QAP and process to identify ahead of time of how you know you have good data, but generally we're looking at something along the lines of data validation, which is going to assess lab error, it's going to assess matrix and interference issues, it's going to assess method anomalies, go to a different word. It's going to allow you to understand, you know, the analysis data on its own, how does it stand. But at the same time, the project teams need to assess the potential error in other areas, in sample selection, in bias introduced, fish comparability, weaknesses in the baseline data. So the data validation, it does address a big chunk of this data quality issues, but there is always going to be this overlay of how reliable was my identification, how, you know, maybe that sample wasn't in the right population, how good were the samples located. Last time we went last year, we got 80% of our samples from around the bend, and this year we got 90% of them, you know, in the other direction. There's a lot of issues there that are going to come down to comparability that at this stage where you're conducting the analysis, you're really talking about data quality. And I think there is a lab or data validation aspect of it as well as a field aspect. But then you get to the making decision point, and this is the appropriate time to assess what the data says. You've already determined previously that the data is usable. The question here is it enough? Does it answer the question? This may be where you're looking at comparative statistics, understanding that whether the data is unusable from validation and whether there are statistical outliers are very different issues. That during that step five to conduct the analysis, that's where I think you do the data quality, looking for usability. This is where I think you're looking at the statistical analysis of the aggregate data. Both of those can affect the confidence in your decision, but they need to be handled differently. If a matrix interference prevents effective quantitation, the data may be rejected and unusable. There is no aggregate data. There's no moving forward from that. This is different than aggregating the data and finding out, gee, why did one size class reduce contaminant concentrations while another increased? There may be, it's unexplained. You may not have a good answer for it, but it's based on good data. It's based on usable data. So it is the reality you're now dealing with, not necessarily having to explain. It depends on how your trends are working. Are you going to do this for 3 years and then come back at the five-year review and make the analysis, or are you going to do it each year? The key is, you know, we're now back to that fourfold multiple choice question. Is it complete? Is it progressing? Is it not progressing? Do we not have sufficient data? Sometimes you can't avoid that fourth ugly alternative. Data is insufficient. But hopefully that's a timing issue, that you've got enough baseline data, you've got 1 year of data, there's some incongruities that you can't maybe explain, but that doesn't mean the data is not usable. You collect another year, you move forward from that. Data that's insufficient based on just not having enough, I think, is something we've all dealt with, versus data that's becoming unusable because there's a problem with the sampling program, which means I need to go back and adjust things along the way so I don't run into this again, or I'm going to continue to have the problems. Hopefully, by walking us through this planning process, you've optimized your chances of getting data that is interpretable and will support a decision. But like I said, sometimes you can't avoid that number four, not enough information, but I always make sure I say yet in there, because the hope is if your program is right, you will get enough data over time. But if not, that's when you really are looking at that number three, and you need to reconsider how you're doing it. Did you make the right decisions along the way, and are you going to be able to make some interpretations? So, well, I thank you for your time. I'm going to hand it off at this point to my colleagues who are going to talk about their case studies. And I believe first up is James Hannenberg, who's going to discuss the Fox River site. So I don't know if this is going back to Matt or directly over to James.
Yeah, Dean, before we go to Jim, I think I'm going to try and squeeze a few more questions in here. Let me pull up some of them. I've gotten a couple on you. We were talking about baseline data and the importance of collecting multiple years of good baseline data. Several questions came in about waiting 3 years to implement a remedy. And so if I could maybe take the first stab at that, a lot of the sites, that RD phase takes a while. So you may already have that built-in time because it takes a couple of years to design your remedy. Not every site has that, and I think one of the big key points to take away is that this idea of collecting baseline fish or biota data earlier in the process and make sure that it's consistent with what you're going to be doing in the long-term monitoring is important to talk about early. And you know, when you're collecting baseline, you may not have all the details that you would later, as particularly if in order to get 3 years of baseline, you have to start before the ROD is signed. But those are, I think, logistical details that you can handle if you start early in the process. And if you don't have that quality baseline, your trend analysis suffers.
And I think, like you say, it's a policy that you'd like to get it, but there are logistic considerations, and that's where I try to say sometimes your ROD isn't exactly what your baseline data is, and you need to have something comparable to the baseline data for the trend analysis, and you need to meet the ROD limits in order to demonstrate effectiveness. So those may be two different programs if you're starting the baseline data collection before the signature of the ROD.
Yeah. And then let's see, a couple other questions. Thanks, Dean. Looking through here, the impact of the frequency of your sampling. One question coming in on the health of the stockfish. How do you factor in, is there enough fish to sample without hurting the stock that you're trying to sample? A couple other questions on it. Let me scroll through here. You have two sampling events for 5 years. What if the species you're looking at grow slower than, say, 5 years, and they won't make it up to the size range you're interested in a period of 5 years?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's why we raise the factor frequently about availability and thinking sort of in your out years, am I going to have the fish? Taking the two sampling events in 5 years certainly is going to cut down the population of some of these larger, long-lived fish. It is going to depend on the site specifics, how many you've got. And I think, you know, it just goes to planning early, but planning with all the factors, not just to get the baseline data, but how am I going to do this going out 10 years, you know, doing, you know, two sampling events in a five-year review period or something like that. It definitely is a factor, and that's why we tried to raise it, but there is no one answer that cuts across all the sites. It depends on availability. Again, in some sites where we've had issues in the past, we've done cage mussel studies as the indicator, or you know, things like that, where it's not necessarily the species you're looking for to completion, but at the same time it provides some level of information about the progress and demonstrate that early progress, which is so important to keeping things on track, to demonstrate within that first five-year review period that you are making progress towards the goals.
Yeah, I agree, and thanks, Dean, for those. We have lots more questions. I'm just going to hit another big group of questions, and then we can move on to our case studies. And this has to do with the fact that not all your media are going to recover at the same rate. So if you've dredged or put a cap in, you might find that your water column or your sediment surface weighted average concentrations recover very quickly, and fish take much longer. Can you kind of step back and look at the long-term management from a bigger perspective? How does the fish tissue fit in with the scenario where you have different rates of recovering for different media?
They're actually concerned with increases in the concentration in the fish because the media is rebounding. This is, again, I keep hate having to keep harp on the baseline data, but that's where if your baseline data is taken at an active period of site control, that's where sometimes the comparison is just apples and oranges, and it becomes very difficult. There is, when dredging, capping, there is this recovery period, and you do see increases that are unexplained, which is why when we're talking about analyzing the data in that last step and making a decision, I tried to point out that you do sometimes see statistical I want to call it anomalies, but it's not really anomalies. You do see trends that you don't want to see, but the data is real. And that's where it becomes a little bit of a sticky point. If the data is usable and the data is validated and the data has no issues, but the answer isn't what you want to hear, the question becomes, you know, well, if I keep going in the out years, am I going to start to see this decrease, or is this just not effective at all? And that is perhaps the toughest question to answer of all when you're doing these sites, especially when you've got multiple remedies being, you know, put into a river, stretch of river, something along those lines, and you're looking at the fish. It becomes very difficult to discern those differences. I don't know if that's very helpful at all.
I think that is responsive. If it's not, please feel free to type in your question again. And actually, Dean, you hit on, I think, one other question, so I'll add it in here. And it's, can you claim you've achieved a remediation goal if not every sample is below your goal?
I don't know if that's a policy question or not for you or I. I can say that.
I'll follow up.
S. Okay. Well, I would say we have claimed that we've achieved the remediation goal. If our plan is for composite sampling, then there definitely could be individual fish that exceed the remediation goal. I'm going to assume this question is even one of the composites came out high, although the average overall. In part, it depends on how the rod is written. The newer rods are, you know, the last 10 years have all been pretty specific about average how you're averaging the concentrations. But I would say, generally, most people would say you could claim it even if you've got a fish over the limit.
I think that's a good start. I would just add that you're right in the older rods and the newer rods. This is a problem if you haven't been specific, because you can argue either way, and we've seen that over and over again at sites. Some of our newer rods have been very specific, and I'm not sure if our case studies will cover it, but just to throw out there, you would want to specify a level considering the variability that you expect to see. And so if your composites are coming in, you know, maybe you're looking for a upper confidence level instead of the mean. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, but it is worth having it written out ahead of time. So if you're a pre-rod, consider this as one of those important details to lock in before you're out there doing your long-term monitoring.
Right. I don't think of these as the hard limits that, say, you know, drinking water can't be over, you know, X milligrams per liter. I think of this as, you know, you're trying to represent a population, and I think that's in good faith with what EPA is trying to do. But I have seen it quite different in the rods, and I think it's something you should deal with.
It's fair to say this is a moving target, and I think we're handling it more appropriately considering variability.
Exactly. I would agree.
All right. Well, thank you, Dean. And we will try and get as many of these questions as we can towards the end. I'm going to move ahead here to Jim. Jim Honneberg, are you online with us, and do you have access to the slide yet? Okay, well, while Jim is unmuting his line and getting elevated in terms of a presenter, Hello. Let me introduce him. Oh, Jim,
hey,
yeah?
Jim, you're unmuted. We can hear you.
Okay, thanks. Checking. Go ahead, Matt.
Thanks, Jim. And again, Jim Honneberg, RPM of the Fox River. He worked in Superfund, EPA Superfund, for 30 years, and he is a geologist by training. So, Jim, congratulations on your retirement. Our lawyers obligated me to state that you are doing this pro bono for free, and that your opinions are your own as you're remembering the work you've done, but do not represent EPA.
Yep.
But anyway, exactly. Thank you very much for coming and presenting.
You're welcome.
And I'll turn it over to you.
Oh, do I control? Oh, I guess I. Oh, okay. Yeah, I was just going to comment. First of all, Dean's presentation was really excellent, and I think provided a nice outline of how to approach developing a long-term monitoring plan. And one thing, just to mention that earlier on, a large group of people developed the long-term monitoring plan for the Platte River, and we really didn't have the six-step process that Dean laid out. We, the group who was involved, I can't say we anymore, but anyway, we had a large group of people. It took us a long time. We spun our wheels for a long time, and if we'd had Dean's six-step process, it probably would have made it a lot more efficient, but we eventually did get there. But anyway, just a general comment. And I'll be talking just about fish. I won't be talking about surface water, although long-term monitoring does include surface water that we have. I also won't be talking about sediment in the long-term monitoring program. There was a disagreement amongst some of the partners. I will not name them. But some partners said that doing or monitoring sediments was a total waste of time because this really, in their view, was not a sediment remediation project. It was a fish remediation project, as they looked at. But others who argued that sediments would be appropriate because there are others who, you know, wanted to see a more complete evaluation. But whatever. In any case, we just did fish. And just to talk about the project real briefly, it's a large sediment project that did have capping and dredging. A large volume of capping has been done. It's a rather costly project, but $1 billion so far, well, before we're done. What we have done so far, you can see on this chart here, and then the remaining next couple years should finish up the project. It just gives you an idea of the scope, and I won't go into all the details as to why these bars are different for different years, but, you know, we've had our ups and downs. But we're approaching completion in the next couple of years. The site has been broken down into five operable units, four in the river, one in Green Bay. And each of these operable units we looked at as a discrete unit in terms of the monitoring. So, for instance, OU1 for Appleton was done, and OU2. And this breakdown was mainly by dams. OU2 has a bunch of dams, and the other OUs have a dam at the front end or the back, the downstream end. By the way, the river flows from southwest to northeast. Let's see, I'll keep going. The fish monitoring, the general approach is very similar to the way Dean outlined it. We looked at the monitoring stations, and for that, it was looked at as to where fish had been found previously. We tried to center our activities around those. Then we also looked at whether you should do composite or individual. And as Dean mentioned, species, number of fish, polar fillet, and statistical consideration. So all that stuff was factored into the plan. Very consistent with what Dean wanted. And Dean mentioned the different collection methods, and he indicated that a very popular one is electrofishing, and that was used a lot. We did use some nets, and there's some limited line fishing in order to fill in the gaps. Time of collection, boy, it was on the Fox, was we did ours in August and September. It had to do with a lot of the factors that Dean talked about. I won't go into this other stuff here. We did do congeners just in order to get the detection limits low enough. And the different primary species that were looked at were walleye and carp, and Dean mentioned an early indicator species, which we did have, was gizzard shad. The reason was it's pretty small and has a fast response. The walleye and carp, hypothetically, would have a much slower response. And one thing that was done was there was some discussion about the longevity of different species, if they would, you know, be extinct in the future or whatever. And so to consider that, well, we did have a secondary species. In case in the future, for instance, if the walleye were to disappear, then we could go to bass. Same for the ecological. We have backup species for that. In this case, with drum. So it just gave us flexibility for future considerations. Dean also mentioned the different aspects of the fish that you do collect. And one thing I was kind of pleased with was Dean mentioned that the magical number for composites is 5. Boy, we were pretty smart. We had 5 also. By we, I mean other people, really. I didn't have that much to do with it in terms of the particulars. I was more from the high level in terms of my project manager spot. But in any case, the way it was handled was walleye was considered for human consumption mainly, and carp and drum would be for ecological. And for, don't ask me to explain it, but for some reason, the walleye for humans, we decided to go with individual samples, not composites. And same with the catfish. Again, these are both human human responders, I guess, or okay, sample for consideration of human consumption, and therefore we looked at the individuals. Also, the size was considered. This is largely just a practical matter. It was thought that ideally this dark gray area is the size that was desired, but if it was outside that, it was considered acceptable, or is considered acceptable, if it's a little smaller or a little bigger than the ideal size range. And then just very briefly to mention the results, there were good results observed for both upriver and downriver. The project is still underway. We've done it a couple years. So only part of the river has been analyzed for long-term monitoring so far. But so far, the results are actually pretty darn good. If you look at the walleye, for instance, upriver, we had about a 66% reduction compared to historical data. And one thing that Dean mentioned was the baseline sampling, which to be fair, in the interest of complete disclosure, we didn't have a great baseline monitoring. We only had one episode, and that was mostly after the project was, or mostly before the project was underway, but in one area it wasn't. So there wasn't the nice 3 sampling events prior to doing the work. So in a perfect world, yeah, 3 is good for sure, but there wasn't 3 sampling events that was able to get done. We only had 1. What we did do was we looked at historical data. Luckily, we had a pretty big data set for historical data, and we were able to do a statistical analysis of the historical data and found that it was acceptable in terms of statistically acceptable, that it would still give us a pretty decent result in terms of something to compare to historical data rather than ideally a baseline data set really would be better, but that didn't happen. And with that, that's my last slide. I'll end it, and hopefully we can stay on schedule and get the other case studies completed. And if there are questions, I can do those later, now, or whenever.
Hey, Jim, thank you. We do have some questions coming in for you. Let's see. Okay, when you're talking about species for human health versus ecological concerns, are you stating that for human it's fillet and for eco it's whole body?
Correct. Yeah, the walleyes and the catfish, they were fillets, right. It was people would normally consume. And, of course, for the ecological, since mink or eagles don't fillet their fish before they eat them, we consider the whole fish to be appropriate.
Just looking
through the table. Yeah, the table shows that it's skin on play, for at least for a walleye. Maybe not. Well, skin, whatever. You'll see the table kind of explains it.
Sure. You have one question, looking for more information on Fox River. Was this a single release, continuous release? Maybe you could give us just a 30-second background on the site.
Okay, it was the contamination was from carbonless copy paper, discharges of waste from the paper mills on the river. It was over a number of years, from 1954 to about 1970 was the time of release of the PCBs. And the carbonless copy paper actually had, I'm losing it now. I think it was like 2.4% by weight PCBs in the carbonless copy paper. So it was a pretty significant amount in the paper itself. And that was the source for the PCBs. But like I say, it was over a period of about, I guess it'd be about 16 years where the releases were underway.
Okay. Thank you. And another, there's a slide showing right now, giving size in inches. Did the weight of the fish come into play when you were determining kind of the minimum size range that you're looking for?
No, not really. We just looked at the size, and then when the range was determined, it was looked at in terms of what would be practical, what might be catchable, what would be present. So that really was the basis for the size range was more just, well, I think there's a thought, although it's not well correlated, but the thought is that, of course, the larger fish are older, but the exact age of this particular size is pretty uncertain. That was another factor in terms of wanting to look at the bigger fish for good, because you get the older fish as well.
Okay.
Well, one thing I didn't mention that was a surprise, actually, was when we looked at the reductions in concentrations, it occurred much larger, much faster, much greater, much faster in the larger fish than we thought they would. So even the large walleye had a large reduction in concentrations fairly rapidly, like within a couple of years. The sampling that we had saw pretty significant reductions in the body burden of even the larger, older fish, which was a surprise. So even optimists like myself were surprised.
I think, in general, we'd be surprised by that. So that's remarkable.
Well, yeah, I know. The conventional wisdom was that it would take a lot longer, if ever, a large fish would have reduced concentrations of the PCBs in the body burden. But they went down pretty quick, even large fish, which was a big surprise.
Jim, we got one last question, and then I'll hold the rest for later after our next case study. Based on the monitoring, is there anything you would have done differently or wished had been done?
I wish we'd had a better baseline program. Wish that had been done earlier on. That would be the one thing that I would be self-critical of, I guess, in that it would have been a lot better if we'd had at least the three sampling episodes that Dean mentioned, which is, makes sense. I know the Hudson, they were able to do that, and maybe we'll talk about that next. But in any case, we didn't have that luxury of time. So by the time we got to doing that, things are pretty far along, so it just didn't work out that way.
Okay.
But in a perfect world, I'd like to have more earlier.
Sure. So that, I guess, back to the earlier comments on getting that baseline data. I see a bunch more questions coming in. So Jim, stand by for later. We'll come back to the Fox River at the end.
Okay. All right.
And for the moment, let's pivot now to Gary and talk about the Hudson River. So Gary is currently the project director for the Hudson River, and I believe he has a horde of RPMs working on the site. So he is kind of the head. Gary, are you on and able to control the slides?
Yes, I'm on, and I can move the cursor, which is perfect.
Excellent. So we'll turn it over to you. Thanks.
Okay. And yes, we do have a horde of RPMs at the site. We do have an office here in Albany that's pretty much dedicated right to the project. So we're got plenty of staff here to get all this work done. For the Hudson River PCB Superfund site, I think most people know where it is. It's it runs basically from the base of the Adirondacks in New York State down to New York City. It's 200 miles long. Oh, sorry, I got to advance my slide here. Apologize. And I think I lost. Here we go. There we go. Okay. The contaminant of concern on Hudson is PCBs. There are two General Electric plants in the northern end of the 200 miles, which basically from there, the PCBs are pretty extensively spread out throughout the 200 miles. Today I'm going to go over a little bit more about the history, considerations of the remedy, considerations related to the remedy, the fish program itself, the little bit about the dredging and the phase that we're in now, which is the monitor natural recovery stage of the project, and I'll go through some of the fish data. So here's a nice graphic that we've been using for years. As you can see, there's a long history on the Hudson project in terms of EPA activities. It's quite a complex site. A couple of things of note, the record of decision was in 2002, which called for the removal of 2.65 million cubic yards of contaminated sediment from the upper portion of the Hudson River, which is the upper 40 miles of the 200 miles. We did phase one dredging in 2009, and then we stopped after 2009, which was somewhat unique for these type of projects, and we went right into peer review, which turned out to be very helpful. We reset the project. I think we've made the project more efficient to work better. We restarted in 2011, and we just finished last year with dredging 2.76 million cubic yards. And now we're at in a very interesting part of the project, which is we're moving into the recovery phase of the project. During the dredging, we removed about 141,000 kilograms, or about 310 pounds. And the way we did the dredging was essentially in 5-acre certification units, and there were 100 of those. So essentially that equates to about 500 acres of dredging. We've dredged as deep as, like, you know, up to 4 or 5, sometimes 6 feet in some places, but generally we dredged about a foot, foot and a half across most areas. Mechanical dredging using environmental buckets. We had one processing facility up in Fort Edward, the northern end of the project area, where we moved all the sediment up to there, which we transported it off-site by, we dewatered it, transported it off-site by rail to approved landfills. So getting into the remedial action objectives for the project, they're pretty standard type remedial action objectives. reduce the cancer risks and non-cancer health hazards for people eating fish. We set targets and a goal for fish based on a species-weighted average, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. That's something that came up in Dean's discussion. So we have point two, point four targets, and then the 0.05 milligrams per kilogram. Then we also have other remedial action objectives related to ecological receptors, reducing PCB levels in sediment, reducing mass, and then one of the more tricky parts of the project, which is reducing the downstream transport. So we did all of our work up in the upper 40 miles, but the site goes all the way down to New York City, so there's the lower Hudson River, and one of the benefits of doing the dredging in the upper 40 miles was to remove enough sediment so that we would see some reductions in the load, going to the lower river. In particular, when we have high flow vents in the Hudson, that's of particular interest because the PCBs get pushed downriver with those events. In terms of the program itself, so we have an unacceptable risk to humans and wildlife due to the fish issues. We've been doing fish monitoring since the 70s. We started our formal baseline program in 2003. We set up that program very much based around the same concepts that Dean went over, in particular making sure that the program had enough statistical power to address assessing long-term and short-term impacts. On the Hudson in particular, so it's in New York State, so one of the key things that we're concerned about and we're assessing is the consumption, the fish consumption advisories, which are controlled by the New York State Department of Health, and then also there's fishing regulations that are controlled by the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. So we're comparing that information that we collect back to those criteria and working very closely with New York State to make sure that we're taking those things into consideration when, especially in particular, when we start to approach those lower numbers. Right now, our fish are, for the most part, in the upper Hudson River in the 2 to 3 part per million range, and, of course, our targets were 0.4, 0.2, and 0.05 for a goal. So what is our program? Our program has to be broken up because we've got basically different portions of the river and different types of situations where we have to look at what fish species are appropriate and how to properly sample throughout the 200 miles. So for the upper Hudson River, which again is the 40 miles, we have a series of 8 pools. And when I say pools, what I mean is we've got basically a series of dams and locks. It's the Champlain Canal. So you've got a series of dams and locks. Some of the pools are long. Some are very, very short. There's little different scenarios in each one. That upper section of the 40 miles is non-tidal, and it's obviously fresh water. And generally, the fish are believed to stay in those pools. And they could migrate downstream over the dams or through the locks, but that's probably pretty limited. For the lower Hudson, different setting. It's tidal. It's a large estuary. It's brackish down in the lower section. There's migratory fish, that can make their way to the ocean. So there's different things to think about. Okay, so for the monitoring itself, we have set up 18 locations, one of which is an upstream target location by Baker's Falls, which is north of the sources of the PCBs, and then 17 downstream stations. We sample across 6 species groups, striped bass, black bass, perch, catfish, the forage fish, pumpkin seed. The pumpkin seed in particular are of particular interest to us because they can be used to by a slot size. We can essentially know that generally that the fish are less than a year old, and we can use those as a good indicator of short-term changes. We collect about 400 sport fish or larger fish in the spring, which is coming up soon for us, beginning with the striped bass that migrate in the lower Hudson. And we take about 125 pumpkin seed, and we take groups of forage fish. And that monitoring has been going on, as I said, for quite some time, and it's going to continue, especially now it's of particular interest to us because the disturbances associated with the dredging are over, and now we're going to get a chance to see actually what's happening post those disturbances. So in terms of species, we are looking, we've got a good distribution of species for the ones that tend to hang out in the water column for the most part, and then the bottom feeders. So again, black bass, striped bass, yellow perch, pumpkin seed, and forage fish for the water column. And the bottom feeders for the catfish, the white perch, the brown bullhead, and yellow bullhead. So in terms of the data, so there's two plots here. One at River Mile 189 for largemouth and pumpkin seed. So the data on these plots is all lipid normalized, so it accounts for the variability in the fat content of the fish. And as you can see, there's the largemouth being representative of a fish that would give us a better indication of long-term trends, and then the pumpkin seed over to the right, which would give us an indication of shorter-term trends, or those fish that are a year old or less. So kind of the takeaways on the charts, in particular, if you notice, there's quite a bit of variability, which isn't unexpected for a fish program. And I think Dean and Matt were talking about that a little bit earlier. Some of that variability is certainly naturally occurring. So changes in the environment, availability of food for the various fish, how fat or thin they might be in a particular year, where they were located throughout the years or the seasons. For us in particular, some of what you see on those plots is simply associated with the fact that we dredged and we caused short-term impacts to some of the fish. And I'll talk about that a little bit more on the next slide. When you look at these sorts of programs in each of the different fish at each of the different stations, each of the species needs to be considered separately and thought about separately. And I think if you start to think about in terms of achieving remedial action objectives, you have to keep in mind that it can be a mixed bag in terms of meeting objectives, where, for us, it won't be surprising to us if we see certain species hit our target sooner than others in different locations in the river, and we will have a challenge to assess that over time and think about how close we are and at what point we would have achieved our remedial action objectives. Also, to kind of play in with that, we are at, as I said, an interesting time. We just finished the dredging. But we also are entering into our second five-year review. So the agency is taking a very close look at the data we have in hand, as well as planning for the future monitoring. In particular, of interest to us would be the fish. I will say, though, that we do, again, kind of follow up on what Dean was talking about and Matt, we do collect we do have a pretty extensive program of water column monitoring and sediment monitoring. So when we do assess the fish over time, which is the most important indicator of the recovery of the river, we also have information about sediment and water to help us sort of diagnose where we may see problems in slower recoveries or whatnot. We can look to the sediment recovery rates and how we're doing in the water column. On this particular plot here, this gives a good indication of the sorts of trends we saw for the period of time during the dredging. So in particular, you'll see the yellow lines, the yellow vertical lines. Those are the years in which we were dredging in the location of those fish. And then the horizontal bar is the mean for that particular station. So essentially what you see is the fish concentrations, as one would expect, go up when we're in the area, working in the area, disturbing the bottom, and then quickly go down afterwards. So we were watching these patterns throughout the implementation, just making sure that we had a good understanding of what was happening with the fish over that period. So as I mentioned, the dredging is complete. We're going into the monitoring phase. We're doing multiple species, which suggests to us that, let me back up for a second. So before we started dredging, we had a period of time between 1995 and 2008, prior to the start of dredging, where there wasn't enough upstream releases happening, or there were, said another way, the source control was going on upstream at the GE facilities. So there was a period of time where we were able to see what the river was doing in terms of recovery. And generally, there's a roughly like an 8% decline across that period of time. Once we started dredging, there was really no ability for us to measure decline over time, although we suspect and it would be reasonable to expect that certain stations and certain places in the river, we did see some recovery during the dredging because we weren't dredging everywhere all the time. So there were places where at some point we got downstream of the fish and they had an opportunity to begin to recover. We're going to continue to collect data and assess data over long term. We think, given where we are right now, we probably need at least 5 years, maybe 8 to 10 years worth of fish data post-dredging to get a good statistically significant sampling that we could start to get an idea of what our post-dredging recovery rate is. So we'll be continuing the program essentially the way it is right now for the foreseeable future. And again, I mentioned that we're doing species-weighted average. The species-weighted average that we're using is based on a creel survey that was done some time ago. So each fish has a different weighting. So I know that Dean was mentioning that, what do you compare to the remedial action objectives? Well, in our case, it's the species-weighted average, and that's a wet-weight average, not a lipid-normalized number. And we do some congener analysis, 1 in 20, just so that we have some comparability and checking on the quantification on the mass or on the concentrations. And with that, Matt, I can take whatever questions there are.
Hi, Gary. Thanks. We've finished the presentations here. We'll have a few minutes for questions for Gary, and then I'll try and loop back and hit some of the many other questions that have come in. One question for you, Gary. Can you clarify the difference between the fish tissue target and the project goal?
Yeah, the targets are set up. Let me just get this right so I don't sometimes mash this up. So we have targets which are based on fish meal per month. So the 0.2 is 1 half-pound meal per month, and the 0.4 milligrams per kilogram is 1/2 pound meal every 2 months. So those are metrics for us to consider along with New York State Department of Health in terms of where are we in terms of what potentially able to be reduced in terms of advisories or considered in terms of advisories.
Thanks, Gary. And another question, you had mentioned some sample processing issues, and folks seem interested in what those were and how they affected your sampling.
I'm sorry, what was that, Matt? Fish processing?
You had mentioned sample processing issues. I just got a couple questions on what the issues were, how they impacted the analysis.
Well, one of the things that we've been doing recently, in particular, we work really close with New York State, and through their working with us and considering what we're doing in terms of the fish processing portion of our work, they pointed out a few things to us that we could improve on in terms of how the fish are processed. So we've been looking closely at our SOPs. We're right now in the middle of making adjustments to our SOPs. So that we try to be as consistent in particular with how we generate a homogenized processed fish or a homogenized sample and how we get to that point. So is the fish filleted correctly? Is the fillet ground up completely? Is it properly removed from the jar and placed into the extraction mechanism? One of the things that we want to do is we understand there's a lot of natural variability out there in terms of the fish themselves, but what we're trying to do is, and not go crazy with this, but reasonably, what can we do that's under our control to get the program as tight or reduce variability to the extent that we can? G's been very cooperative with us on that. We've been working with them, their lab, New York State. We're actually getting together with GE and New York State at the lab to look at these things all together so that we make sure the SOPs appropriately fit what everybody expects to see happen.
Thanks, Gary. You know, I think that answer gets to a couple other questions here, so I'll dive into it. Can you explain how you're doing the species average, species weighting averaging? And also, given that you're using that method, how does that jive with the states and their fishing advisory and fish regulations?
Yeah, that's a good question. The breakdown of how we do the fish weighted or the species weighted average, I don't know right off the top of my head, but I'll just give you an example. You know, like the white perch would be like, let's say, 8%, and the black bass would be 15%, and then you basically take across the five fish that we primarily sample, and you would essentially come up with what a typical person might have in their creel or their collection of catched fish that they would consume. So I think that we do have some more discussions to have with the state about the fish advisories in particular, because EPA doesn't remove the fish advisories, Department of Health does. So I don't want to speak for them in terms of specifically what they'll be looking for from us as we get closer. Since we're a bit, we're a bit removed from the point of having reductions in fish advisories, we haven't really had that chance to really have those dialogues. I didn't mention this, but it was in my notes to mention it. If folks don't know, the Hudson River is essentially catch none, eat none for most of the river. All of the upper Hudson, and there's only a few species that have some limited ability to be consumed in the lower river. So it's essentially, the fish are basically not edible in the Hudson, period.
All right. Well, thank you, Gary. We've got more questions there, but with about 11 minutes left, I'd like to get back to some of the bigger questions. And at this point, hopefully, Dean and Jim and Gary, you're all unmuted and able to respond here. I'll go first to Jim with some questions on the Fox. We've got a couple questions, Jim, about your goal. Can you give us the fish tissue concentration that you're trying to achieve? Was it based on human health or eco health? And also, go ahead. I'll give you the second part in a minute.
It's based on, depends on the species, but for the human fish that humans would consume, is based on human consumption. It was not in the rod. It was, we said in the rod, kind of a vague general goal was unlimited fish consumption for humans was the main thing that we said. And I don't think we actually said in there anything about the ecological, but of course ecologicals, you know, have different goals, so to speak.
Okay, and what was that fish tissue concentration?
Oh, well, for humans, for instance, for walleye, it's 50 parts per billion.
Okay.
That would be the level that you'd have unlimited fish consumption. And we were pretty close to that up in the first operable unit, the first sampling, actually. We were pretty darn close. But the fish advisories are kind of a different kind of an apples and oranges kind of thing compared to what we're looking at. So that was talked about a little bit. But.
And Jim, what was your post-remedy PCB SWAC for the Fox River?
0.25 was a goal, and it was 0.25 part per million, sorry. And we actually achieved that up in OU1. In OU3, we're pretty close also. OU4, still underway, so don't know. OU2 was monitoring natural recovery, so it really wasn't a goal set, at least in the short term for that. But the goal was achieved for OU1 and for OU3 as well. So, in a way, surprising to some people.
All right.
The way it was achieved was a combination of capping and sand covering because, as is typical, we did have residual concentrations in the dredged areas, but we took care of that with a residual cover. So that got us low enough. The areas that, of course, we didn't touch, in some cases, we were more than 0.25, but we ended up with an overall average of 0.25 part per million.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. I'm going to pivot now to broader questions. And Dean, I'll direct this one at you and anyone else. And feel free to jump in afterwards. We had an earlier question regarding water column sediment and also passive sampling data. And this question is a clarification. Do you need to collect those different data sets in order to understand your fish tissue data, or is it simply adequate to have a trend and an end goal in mind with the fish tissue you're collecting?
I would say, again, this may be a little bit more of a sort of policy, which way, how it's implemented in different regions, but my thought is that there are several cases where just having the fish tissue data and seeing the trend and establishing the goal is really all that's needed. The problem is when it doesn't work, and you've got issues with temporary increases in the sediment because of the rebound or concentrations, or the water column is stirred up, and so you've seen temporary increases in the fish. It's often hard to explain those away without that data or understand sort of the mechanism of what's happening. But if everything goes perfectly, you got a good baseline set of data, in theory, all you would need would be the fish.
Okay, and Gary, Jim, anything to add on there?
Yeah, I agree with what Dean is saying. I think it's more about what site-specific, you know, is it a, you know, what is the extent of the contamination? How bad is it? What are you trying to accomplish? I mean, obviously, the Hudson's sort of on the end of the spectrum there where we've got a large area with fish that are of higher concentration. And in order to, with a fairly significant component of recovery expected, so for us, we need the we need not only the fish, but we need the sediment in the water in order to assess the full system.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's best to have all the media, data on all the media, in order to really understand the total system.
Okay, thanks, folks. And then another question here relates to the technology used for remediation. Would you have different, and I'm summarizing several questions here, would you have different recommendations for monitoring fish tissue under different remedial technologies, for example, dredging compared to monitored natural recovery or capping?
I guess I would say that, you know, in general, no. I think the process is the same and the factors are the same, but the site specifics can be all over the place and can drive you in a certain direction. I mean, I think if you're looking at monitored natural attenuation, you may well achieve your sediment goals and be quite a while trying to achieve your tissue goals. It depends on how things are how your rod's written, but you know, you oftentimes can see a decrease in the sediment. But if you're not doing something to either cap or dredge the sediments, oftentimes the fish are not gonna just decrease on their own. Not to the level that they should.
And I guess I would point the question to our two case studies, because I know you had areas at your site with you know, different technologies applied. So.
Yeah, Matt, it's Gary. What I would say on that one is one thing I've thought about, one of my plots was actually that plot regarding the uptake and the, you know, the uptick in the concentrations of the fish during the implementation phase. For us, we collected an awful lot of data during that period, and our implementation period was quite long. It was many years. And you know, you kind of look at that data and you say, well, you know, how useful is that data? Really, you know, I think some of these programs can be adjusted based on, you know, what's happening. Where are you? What stage of the project are you at? And, you know, to be efficient, plus, you know, you're taking hundreds of fish, for example, for us. I mean, we're taking a significant number of fish out of the river, too. So it's a big effort. It's costly, and I think a mindful, you know, looking as you guys have laid out, as you've laid out the strategies and the planning for these fish programs, I think that should come into play, which probably is part of what you've got. Just to, like, where are we in this, what stage are we at, and what do we really need so that we're not just taking, you know, getting information when it may not be too useful depending on what stage you're at, or maybe more useful to have more data at a different stage, so kind of throttling those levels of effort.
Well, I can tell you the really PRP. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Jim. Sorry. Go ahead, Jim.
I was just going to say that people paying the freight, the PRPs, in most cases who are paying for the monitoring, they're desperately seeking exit strategies. This is an observation. And a lot of times, you know, they will propose exit strategies for maybe just part of the group of fish that you have. So if you have a particular species that might be low enough, then you know, they'd be probably petitioning the agency to terminate that monitoring for that particular species if it gets low enough. That's a general kind of desire, I guess you'd say. To reduce
all I was going to add is that I think the site specifics are so important that it's just really hard to generalize. You're dealing with complex sites like the Hudson's and the Fox Rivers, versus others that are, you know, enclosed ponds with no, you know, really contiguous, you know, that can easily be isolated. It's just very different on the approach. I mean, the approach is the same, but I guess the answers you get to are can be quite different.
Well, thanks, fellas, for your presentations and answering all these questions. We have a very long list of questions here, and I do apologize for not getting to all of them. At this point, we have 1 minute left, and you know, there are some follow-up messages to send you. Gene, are you online still?
Yes, I am, and I'll go ahead and start the closeout procedures if you're ready for today.
We've got 30 seconds, and I can't hit any more questions than we've so far. So thanks everybody.
Sorry, here. Excellent. Let me walk through a few final reminders. For those of you who enjoyed today's broadcast and would like to participate in future webinars, I encourage you to sign in or follow us on the Cleanup Information Network. You'll find us at cluin.org. Or you can also check in with us through popular social and professional networking sites. I do want to remind everyone that a copy of the presentation materials is currently available to download from the seminar homepage. It's going to be active from this point forward, so if you want to come back later on or you want to get to it now, those slides are available to download in print. Contact information for all of our presenters and organizers is also found on that seminar homepage. You can refer to it at a later time if need be. And I also want to ask if you can, in the last second I have, please take a moment to share your feedback for today's webinar. We did include a URL in the Q&A window so you can share feedback on today's session. I do read each and every submission for all of our webinars, and that helps us continue to offer these free internet seminars to the public. We had just under 290 individuals join us from all over the country for today's live session, so I do encourage each of you to take a moment to fill out that form and share your thoughts. Today's session was recorded and will automatically be archived. You should receive an email in approximately 1 to 2 weeks when that archive is ready. If you happen to be one of the lucky ones replaying today's webinar, you can still download the slides and fill out feedback based off of your replay of the archived webinar. One last question that I'll cover. We oftentimes get requests for certificates or CEUs or PDHs. I'll just say this. We don't necessarily issue CDUs or PDHs for our sessions. However, many participants earn credit for attending our sessions. Save a copy of that registration email, save a copy of the materials that we presented today, and fill out the feedback form. When you fill out the feedback form, there is a small box you can check near the top to request the confirmation email to be sent to you for your own records. Make sure you check that box and send your feedback on in. And then that'll generate an email that you can couple with the other resources, and that's usually enough to verify that you attended the live broadcast today. If you need anything else, feel free to email me directly at ballant.gene@epa.gov. And with that, let me send my thanks to all of the organizers and presenters who joined us today and those of you who signed in from around the country to join us for today's live broadcast. This will be the formal conclusion for today's seminar.